Talk Back with Gary Null, Sundays at 8 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I call this the Empowerment Hour, because I can promise you, no matter what your background in life, you will be given insights and information that, if you choose, can provide you with a different way of looking at the world we live in, our health, and longevity. Today, a lot of time I will set aside for your calls, your questions and thoughts and statements. But also, I'm going to share from Mike Adams, Natural News, what is really behind the death of the birds and the fish. Also, the latest on why we should not be supporting genetically modified foods, an interesting study that has not made any of the American media, but I'll share it with you. And also, time permitting, and I don't know that we'll have enough time for everything, two commentaries. I currently have about 60 commentaries on hold. I'll be giving one each day, but I might give one or two today, including one, the class war launched by America's wealthiest is getting more savage, by Larry Beinhart from Aldernet. And there's a global aristocracy in the making, and the greedy super rich think they've earned it, by Lindsay Beierstein from Media Consortium. I'm going to ask you not to make any calls right now until after I share the latest in health and nutrition, some commentaries, because I'm quite sure that some of the things I'm going to be sharing may provoke some thoughts for you. First, the latest on health and nutrition, always from quality peer-reviewed literature. For example, this is from the peer-reviewed journal Diabetes, Obesity, and Metabolism. And it says the following: magnesium can reduce diabetes risk. That's right. I would suggest in the neighborhood of 600 milligrams of magnesium, and this study shows that it reduces the risk by improving sensitivity to insulin, and that in turn reduces the risk of diabetes, and especially in overweight people. Quote, the results of this current study provide significant evidence that magnesium supplementation ameliorates insulin resistance in obese and insulin resistant subjects. That was from Professor Morin, the Institute of Sports Sciences at Justus Liebig University in Germany. Most people don't take magnesium supplements. The amount that you get in an average, let's say, supplement is probably in the neighborhood of 200 milligrams. I would suggest 600 to 1,000 milligrams. From Science Daily, from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, here's what it says. Over the long haul, money doesn't buy happiness. I'll just quote this. It says, a new collaborative paper by economist Richard Easterlin says that happiness does not improve with growing economics. They studied 37 countries, rich and poor, ex-communists and capitalists, and all in between, and they found this, that, quote, this article rebuts recent claims that there's a positive long-term relationship between happiness and income, when in fact the relationship is non-existent. Here are my thoughts on this, because I'm very sensitive to this issue since I have been filming literally every day on this topic of poverty, but not the old poverty, but the new poverty, and poverty in the likes of which we have not seen since the Great Depression. In fact, two reports tomorrow, housing slump worse than the Great Depression, and also how propaganda poisons the mind and discourse, and austerity policies worsen racial economic inequalities, meaning if you're black and Latino, you're going to be far harder hit by the economic downturn. And when was the last time you saw anything in the media, on either the left or the right, talking about what it means to be the new poor in America, following a family, for example, through a day? What do they do? Where do they go? Where do they eat? Where do they go to the bathroom? Where do they shower? Where do they sleep? If you did, as I've been doing, you'd find out that there's virtual chaos out there and little to no real assistance. No one is facing this problem. Because if we did, we'd see that it was so incredibly large. We're talking about 6 million Americans have been thrown out of their home. There's four people per home. That's 24 million Americans right there. Then our real unemployment level is about 37 million Americans underemployed, stopped looking, working at two jobs, and still not making ends meet, and are at the poverty level or unemployed. We're not talking about this, because if we do, and if we're honest, we'll see that the very people that we've been relying upon for advice, the economists like Larry Summers, or the people in the White House or in Congress, are the ones who put us here. So we simply avoid the problem altogether. We fake folks on happy news, or we look at other problems and personalities that have nothing to do with solving any of the major problems we have, ecological problems, economic problems, human suffering problems. But along the way, I can tell you what it's meant for individuals to know that they have a home or an apartment and food and a regular income and a support system. Well, that requires money. And what's happened is that it's easy when you're looking at people in cultures such as in France or Italy or Spain, they have social safety nets far better than anything here and less politicized. They don't make as much money. You don't see massively wealthy groups of people like you have 8 million millionaires in the United States. You don't have that anywhere else in the world. But you also don't see people falling down the same way we do here. So I believe they're completely wrong. I believe that if we had better distribution of our financial resources, which is very easy to do, you don't have to take the money away from the wealthy, is what the people on the right or the conservatives would like you to believe. Rather, you simply provide a greater take-home pay, pay more per hour, get people a living wage so at least they can pay their bills and have some standard of living. And by the way, it only helps the economy, because when people have more money, they'll go out and buy things. If they don't have money, then they're not going to buy unless it's with a credit card. It's going to create more debt. So, and a lot of that debt will be led to bankruptcy. So I believe that at a certain point, yes, if you're upper middle class, having more money or wealthy, it's not going to make a difference in your happiness level. Happiness can come even when you're poor. And this idea that happiness is always tied to money is wrong. But also, when you have no money and you have no food, you don't know where you're going to sleep tonight. And as I just filmed a bunch of vets, one vet stays awake for 3 hours while the others sleep, because there's constant attacks against homeless people, especially homeless women. We never talk about all the rapes and beatings and muggings and theft of homeless women. And the shelters are no better. Sexual abuse and theft occurs in all the shelters. In any case, give them some money. You bet it's going to make them happier. So when you do a study and you leave 240 million people out of the equation in the United States, what a faulty study. If you're just talking about the rich, I would agree, because I've never seen anyone who is really rich that more money made him happier. Conquest, temporarily, it's their fix. They don't need the money. But they sure do feel insecure without it. So they'll say, yeah, I need more. It makes me happy. It doesn't. Next up, I want to share some insights about oxytocin. I've talked about oxytocin on this program. It's not being used in a way that could really make a difference. By the way, every time that you share love, warmth, hugs, intimacy, you're releasing oxytocin, and it allows someone to even extend that warm time, that affection time, even longer, or remember it longer after you've shared it. Because it's an authentic hormone, and therefore you have a hormone that actually creates a memory. in the cell a pleasure. Now, some people, it's a wonderful meal that can release oxytocin. Some people, it's going to a wonderful concert or reading a fine book. And that's why we keep coming back to the things in life that are very pleasing to us. And there's nothing wrong with that. But there's one thing we could do with oxytocin. Give it to children with autism. Because when oxytocin, which is a natural hormone, is given to children with autism, they make better eye contact and they're able better to interact with others. This is a French study earlier this year, and it found that when the children inhaled oxytocin, they improved in face recognition scores and had enhanced performance in games. And the results of the study indicate this hormone could help those with autism function better. This was done at the National Center for Science Research in France. Quote from the study, administering the hormone soon after a child's autism is diagnosed might help him or her develop more normally. It's possible it can become a cure if it's given early when the problems are detected in the little kids. Unquote. That's a powerful statement. So that's good. In fact, oxytocin can alleviate be activated naturally in the body as well. A UCLA study demonstrated the connection of touch and oxytocin release. Volunteers were either massaged or asked to wait in a room for 15 minutes. Researchers measured blood oxytocin levels for each person before and after the experiment. And those who had received a massage had an increase in blood oxytocin levels. And men did not have this high an oxytocin level as women. They normally don't. But it's one more reason why holding hands, massage, stroking the hair, touching the cheek, simple things, nurturing, can make a big difference. And by the way, I've also seen in primates that works the same way. When I have a chance to get to my home, which is not often right now, I have some capuchin little monkeys and ringtails, and there's different species. But the capuchin's extremely sensitive and very smart. And when this man had a heart attack, couldn't take care of his baby capuchin anymore, he asked, would I take it? And I said, okay. But it also meant it's like having a little baby. You got to change the diapers 10 times a day. You have to bottle feed him. It's a lot of attention. But I said, it's okay. Because also I enjoy the bonding. And that little wonderful creature was in its travel case for 3 days. I'd put food and water there, but it wouldn't come out. And then one day while I'm sitting at my desk, I see this little tiny finger come out and touch my finger and then pull back. So I just left my hand there, and then it came out and it touched my finger again and pulled back. Well, it was doing this for probably 3 hours until it came out and then it grabbed my finger. And then suddenly I see this adorable little head come out with these little eyes looking up at me. And then I was able to change his diaper and bond with it. I made a little pocket on my shirt and I kept it in there. And when they're bonding, and they're tactile, when they're touching you, they'll purr. And that's when that oxytocin is coming out. That's when you're creating the bond. And therefore, that becomes their security. So anytime then I go around, suddenly they're on me and bonding and hugging. I mean, hugging like you wouldn't believe. They'll put their arms around your neck and their cheek up to your cheek, and then they'll purr. And I think one of the things a lot of Americans right now need is some hugging, some compassion, and sensitivity and simple touch. So let's help the kids with autism. It's a good study, and it's needed. Also, a new therapy for helping with depression was introduced at the University of Illinois by Dr. John Davis. And they use the omega-3 fatty acids. I'll quote this. Researchers from the University of Illinois at Chicago have confirmed that omega-3 fatty acids exhibit powerful antidepressant and brain-boosting benefits that have not received the high level of attention they deserve. The team led by Dr. John Davis discovered that the EPA and the DHA, two types of omega fatty acids recognized for their powerful nutritional benefits, are effective enough at improving mood that they may potentially eliminate the need for any more people taking antidepressant drugs. The researchers analyzed 15 randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled studies on omega-3 and found that taking the EPA alone or taking it with DHA helps to alleviate depression symptoms. And since DHA alone did not exhibit antidepressant benefits, the team identified EPA as the primary active compound. By the way, that's brand new. Everyone thought it was DHA. Quote, our analysis clarifies the precise type of omega-3 fatty acids that is effective for people with depression and explains why previous findings have been contradictory. The EPA predominate formulation is necessary for the therapeutic action to occur. And people who are deficient in omega-3 fatty acids are more likely to experience depression than people who have consumed adequate amounts. Davison's team found in a previous study that pregnant women deficient in omega-3 fatty acids are more prone to depression during and after pregnancy. And so that's good news. And so your omega-3 fatty acids, that means if you take flaxseed oil, you're getting the EPA part of that in a good way. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We're going to come back in a moment. And I asked someone in my audience, Bill Thompson in Florida. Bill, you talk about government. You also discuss issues of human rights. What would happen if there was a movement towards humanistic libertarianism, where you cut the bottom off the part of libertarianism that dismisses people who have needs, but instead combine the best of humanistic and libertarian values? It was a discussion we were having, and he sent this. This is from Bill Thompson. The term libertarian often conjures images of anarchy, plights faced by those truly deserving of help from a libertarian society may be overlooked or even ignored because individual self-reliance is the rule. Perhaps in a perfect world, if all people shared the ability to become self-reliant, then an orthodox libertarian society could flourish. Unfortunately, the world is not perfect. There will always be those who need assistance, and the responsibility of the community necessarily must extend to those who are disadvantaged. There is a path, however, to embrace the precepts of libertarianism and provide what the United States Constitution calls, quote, the general welfare. An original aspect of humanistic philosophy, not to be confused with secular humanism, in the mid-17th century, as the French described, quote, the general love of humanity. That meaning in modern times has been taken to mean that society should take substantial steps in order to protect people from themselves and from a society or culture bereft of caring for each other. But there is something, sometimes a dark side, to the humanistic ideology. Humanists sometimes attempt to force ideals, ethics, and lifestyles onto others they perceive to have limited capability of conducting their own affairs. Humanists tend to be egocentric, believing they are uniquely suited and perhaps divinely imbued with all the society's challenges. It can be described as social vanity. Combining the best merits of these two philosophical thoughts, a hybrid of ideologies, is born in humanistic libertarianism. Self-reliance, freedom of choice, smaller but more effective government, government entitlement programs that are limited to those in true need, and a scaled-back military commitment to protect the borders of the country and stopping all wars. Libertarianism is complemented with the desire and willingness to offer assistance to others when social and non-secular organizations fall short of coming to the aid of those in true need. In the spirit of the 17th century humanism, quote, the general love of humanity, but with reason, motivating individuals to understand the nature of wrongs and a willingness to right them, offering solutions for the general welfare that are guided by common sense, building a society and infrastructure within our borders, and avoiding the infringement of any outside sovereignty while demanding respect for our own. These are the principles of humanistic libertarianism. Bill Thompson. Okay. And as we're going forward, we know the existing models of Democrat and Republican, conservative and liberal, although each has some principles that one could define as common sense or rationality, there are also gross limitations, and many of those underlying original decent principles, like a Jeffersonian philosophy, have been usurped by corporatists. And today, both the Democrats and Republicans are more often than not corporatists, serving a corporate agenda, no matter how they massage it. So what are your thoughts? What would you like to see us become, maybe creating a third party? I'd like your thoughts on that. And I'll ask you to call in a few moments, and I'll give you the number so you can share your thoughts. Here's something that I'm always interested in what people have to say about Thomas Jefferson. Here's what Jefferson said. The democracy will cease to exist when you take away from those who are willing to work and give them those who would not. That's Jefferson. It is incumbent on every generation to pay its own debts as it goes, a principle which, if acted on, would save one half the wars of the world. I predict future happiness for Americans if they can prevent the government from wasting the labors of the people under the pretense of taking care of them. My reading of history convinces me that most bad government results from too much government. No free man shall ever be debarred the use of arms. The strongest reason for the people to retain the right to keep and bear arms is, as a last resort, to protect themselves against tyranny in government. To compel a man to subsidize with his taxes and propagation of ideas which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. Those are just a few. And finally, he says, I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. Your thoughts. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. To welcome all of you, I'm Gary Nall. In just 2 minutes, I'll ask you to call in, but not before. From Larry Beinhart, alternate. The class war launched by America's wealthiest is getting more savage. This is a short commentary. We're in a class war. It's the corporations and the very wealthiest against all the rest of us. And we are losing. In 1962, the wealthiest 1% of American households had 125 times the wealth of the median household. Now it's 190 times as much. Is that a case of rising tide lifting all boats, or just a few of them a little bit higher? No. From 1950 to 1965, median family income rose $24,000, that were at $24,000, rose to $38,000. That's a 4% a year. Close to 60% over 15 years. That's a rising tide, and that's a good thing. In 1964, there was a big tax cut. That's when things started to slow down for average people. By the mid-1970s, the rise of the middle class stalled. From 1975 to 2010, median family incomes rose from $42,000 to $49,000. That's not quite 16% over 25 years, less than 0.6% a year. Briefly, when taxes went up under Clinton, median income rose, peaked at $52,000 in 1999, and then after Bush tax cuts, it declined. Keep in mind that that is a median family income. In the 1950s and 60s, family income was usually earned by a single person. Today, family income, more often than not, is earned by two people. At the same time, income for the richest soared. In 1969, the richest 1% of Americans earned 9% of all U.S. income. Now they earn 24% of all money in the United States. 1% of Americans earn nearly one-fourth of all the income in the country. Then came the crashes 2001 and 2008, and the recessions have followed. The crash hasn't changed anything. Things have become worse. From 1990 to 2005, adjusted for inflation, the median wage is down 9%. Production workers' pay is up only 4.3% for 15 years. At the same time, the rich get richer. Corporate profits are up 106%. The S&P 500 is up 141% since 1990. CEO compensation is up 282%. Call it transfer of wealth, or call it class warfare. Now, what's wrong with the rich getting richer? Slate's Timothy Noah, quote, "The United States of Inequality," wrote, "Income distribution in the United States has become more unequal than in Nigeria, in Nicaragua, Venezuela, and roughly on par with Uruguay, Argentina, and Ecuador." Take a look at this. Countries with wide income inequality don't lead the world in research, technology, industry, and innovation. They're unstable. They have large underclasses. They have high rates of crime. They have little opportunity. In such countries, the rich have disproportionate power. They take control of all aspects of society. They especially covet government, the police, and the judiciary. They become self-perpetuating. If current trends continue, quote, "the United States will have the same income inequality as Mexico." Countries with high levels of income inequality become third world countries. Here's how regular people can deal with cultures of high inequality. The primary and best weapon is a progressive tax structure. As people move up the income ladder, they pay a higher rate at each rung. Unearned income from dividends and capital gains is taxed at least as high as earned income, money that people actually work for. Tax cuts for the wealthy mark with great precision the decline in fortunes of ordinary Americans. Tax cuts for the wealthy mark with equal precision the increase in inequality. We had a chance to slow the process of letting the last round, the Bush tax cuts, expire. We lost that round. Your thoughts? I'd like to hear your thoughts on the inequality in America and how it could lead to instability, crime, massive poverty, and problems in the streets. I'll now open it up for your calls after one last comment here, and this is something that we've been saying. After all, haven't we heard about all the fish? And then I took a look at all the different ways that we were told about the fish and bird kills in the United States, and a timeline for all these mysterious bird deaths and fish deaths. Starting on December 13th, thousands, quote, "dead of a Barmanundi fish washed up in Australia, causes unknown." Then on the 15th, thousands of dead fish washed ashore in Florida Beach, blamed on cold weather. And then a day later, dead fish washed ashore at Lake Beach in Indiana, blamed on winter storms. And then each day after that, we had thousands of dead fish turn up in a bay in the Philippines, unknown causes. More than 100 dead pelicans turn up in North Carolina, unknown. Hundreds of dead sea creatures wash up in South Carolina, blamed on cold water. 10 tons of dead fish found in fishing nets in New Zealand, unknown. Scores of dead fish washed ashore in a lake in Haiti, unknown. Causes, 70 bats found dead in Tucson, Arizona, unknown. Dozens of fish found dead in San Antonio, Texas, unknown. 5,000 birds dead in Arkansas, and suffering massive trauma and blood clots. 100,000 dead fish found in Arkansas River, unknown. And it went on. Always unknown. Well, ponder this. Following the unexplained deaths of several thousand birds and fish over the last several weeks, events are now emerging that may offer a physics-based explanation for the mysterious deaths. It all begins on a runway in Tampa. You heard me right, where airport officials recently closed that runway in order to change the numeric designators painted there. Now, why are those numeric designators being changed? Because the Earth's magnetic poles are shifting, and the numbers previously painted on the runway no longer match up with the magnetic measurements of sensitive airplane equipment. Let's give you an example. This is from a physics.org website. Quote, "The primary runway at the airport is designed 18R-36L, which means the runway is aligned along 180 degrees from north, that is due south when approaching from the north and 360 degrees from the north when approaching from the south. Now the Federal Aviation Administration has requested their designation be changed to a 19R1L to account for the movement in that North Pole. This brings up our first physics fact. Fact one, the Earth's magnetic poles are shifting, not just a little, but enough to affect airport runways on the scale of human observation. The role of the Earth's magnetic fields most people are unaware of. The Earth's magnetic field is extremely important for protecting the planet from so-called solar wind and other electromagnetic influences from space. The magnetosphere, which is driven by the Earth's magnetic field, serves a kind like an electromagnetic barrier to prevent dangerous rays from reaching the surface of the planet. You can see a picture if you go to theozonehole.com. Physics fact number two, the Earth's magnetic field has flipped hundreds of times in the past, and in fact over the last several thousand years. This is called geomagnetic reversal. In between these flips, the magnetic field can become weak or chaotic, causing turbulence in the field, which can effectively cause weaker gaps in the magnetosphere. Now, these magnetic gaps or weaknesses can allow outside influences that normally would not penetrate the atmosphere to reach deep into the magnetosphere, theoretically all the way down to where birds fly or were at lower levels. And last week, a report from the Russian Ministry of Extraordinary Situations warned that the weakening Earth magnetosphere was allowing, quote, poisonous space clouds to enter deep into Earth's atmosphere where it's coming into contact with birds. And these space clouds are called a special type of noctilucent clouds, which exist at very high altitudes, about 50 miles, and accumulate space dust from micrometeors and other sources. What's really interesting here is that these clouds exhibit very high radar reflectivity. This means that these clouds create a very large radar signature on weather tracking systems. Now, physics fact number three, these clouds have very high radar reflectivity, whether radar tracks phenomena during bird kill. Now, here's where this story really gets interesting. On New Year's Eve, when birds began falling out of the sky in Arkansas, the National Weather Service in North Little Rock documented an unusual phenomenon on their radar monitors. Quote, there are some indications that we're picking up a non-precipitation target, unquote, said science and operations officer there. He went on to explain that the radar signature definitely was not indicative of a cloud or rainstorm. Quote, it was something altogether different. At or around the same time this radar image appeared, birds began falling out of the sky. Over the last several weeks, hundreds of thousands of birds and fish have been found dead across the globe. And I gave you the... it's just one possible explanation. The working theory in all this is, at least for the birds, that is that deadly space clouds are reaching into the lower atmosphere and killing these birds in flight, after which the birds fall to the ground. The report of the birds experiencing blunt trauma are likely from the birds hitting the ground. What exactly would be found in these deadly space clouds that might be killing the birds? One possibility is that these clouds might be moving along with gaps in the sphere that would invite some radiation to affect the birds in flight. That's just one possibility. So those are possibilities. Could it affect humans? Don't know. It is of concern. It's theoretical. It's hypothetical. But if these poisoning clouds can be measured, and if there's also any hydrogen cyanide, and the most likely explanation is the birds might have been killed in flight by changes in the composition of the air they were breathing. As it turns out, the clouds are largely made up of a poisonous gas known as hydrogen cyanide. And by the way, hydrogen cyanide is also formed in interstellar clouds through one of two pathways. So that's something for us to ask our officials and ask them to research. That's it for me. Now I'm going to turn this over to you. You can give us a call at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'll be looking for your calls to come in here. And one little thought as you're calling in now is thank you for sending this email to me. Someone asked the other day, quote, what was your favorite fast food when you were growing up? Friends, we didn't have fast foods when I was growing up. We had food that was slow food. Well, that might seem like a surprise to people today, but my mother cooked every day, and we sat down at the dinner table, and if I didn't like what was on my plate, I was allowed to sit there until I liked it. And kids today would find that rather amusing because they don't eat what they don't want to, and frequently what they eat is not good for them. But also understand a lot of things have changed. A lot of parents where I grew up did not own their own house. They didn't wear Levi's. They never been on a golf course. They didn't travel outside the United States. Nobody had a credit card. No one had a cell phone. No one had a computer. And my parents never drove me to school. I ran to school where I had a bicycle that weighed about 50 pounds and only had one speed slow. I still have that bike. We didn't have television for a long time, and when we did, it was in black and white, and the station went off the air at midnight after playing the national anthem. It came back on at 6 in the morning, and there was no telephone in anyone's room, and the telephone we had where I was growing up, it was a party line, so you just couldn't dial. You had to wait to hear if someone else was on there. And we didn't get pizzas delivered to our home. We did get milk unpasteurized where I grew up. And it was organic milk. All the newspapers got delivered early. I was a paper boy. I know I had to get up at 4 o'clock, and in the wintertime, that was not cool. But everybody where I grew up in a small town got up by 5 o'clock, and so they won their paper there. By the time they got up, so I had to have the papers all delivered by 6. And so it was a different way of looking at life. And I can remember when headlights had dimmer switches on the floor. Ignition switches were on the dashboard. Pant leg clips for bicycles without chain guards. Soldering irons you heat on a gas burner. And using hand signals to turn. You actually had to know the hand signals before you could get the driver's license. And all the coffee shops had tableside jukeboxes. And everything that was delivered as far as milk was in a glass bottle. And you could see a double feature for a quarter. Howdy Doody was on television, 45 RPM records with a hit, hi-fis were cool, metal ice trays with a little lever, blue flash bulbs, Studebakers, all that. And so people think, well, that was kind of a corny time, was it? Not for a lot of us. That's why today many of us look for a quality of life where it slows down and you appreciate what you have. We're going to take calls now. It's your turn after this break. And then Dr. Martin Feldman is going to talk about selenium and dispel some myths. Again, call in with anything you'd like to share, any questions you have. The phones are open. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment with your calls. Say hello to Rose in Maryland. Hi, Rose. You're on the air.
Hi, Gary. Thank you very much for taking my call. I just finished watching a segment of 60 Minutes, and I thought of you because I understand that you have a lot of knowledge about alternative treatments for schizophrenia using an orthomolecular model. And I was wondering if you could let us know some of your knowledge in that area. Also, if it has any relationship to Dr. Feldman's parameters for diagnosis and treatment of depression, are they related in any way? If you could talk about that, because it's so important with all these killings, everybody's saying, oh, maybe it's political and maybe it's something else, but obviously there's a schizophrenic component to this, and perhaps you could advise on its treatment.
Okay. Well, I don't accept schizophrenia in the typical manner because there is no brain chemical imbalance that you can show that defines a person as schizophrenia. They've been trying to find this for a long time. They classify schizophrenia as either catatonic schizophrenia, where a person has very rigid posture and doesn't move, frenzied movements, or disorganized schizophrenia, which is where a person lacks normal range of emotions. For example, they simply couldn't speak or display their emotions. And then paranoid schizophrenia, where a person walks around with all forms of hallucinations and delusional symptoms, or undifferentiated schizophrenia, which is a mixture of all that. And more often than not, I believe that what we're dealing with is an individual that, if it weren't for the politicians and the people killed, if you go into every city in America that has violence on a daily basis and look at the killings, if you suddenly had a politician killed instead of a relative or an ex-or neighbor or worker, then you would have an awful lot of people that we'd be diagnosing this with. So I believe that we should stop with the labeling and pull back and ask ourselves, what happens when a person becomes so stressful, stressed out, that they cannot cope? They don't have the coping mechanisms to be able to set aside and go to neutral their anger, their pain, their frustration, and then they resort to a violence, justifying it. Also, 95% of all the people who've gone into a place with a gun to kill people have been on antipsychotic medications. This is a national epidemic. And whether or not this person was on any medications, I don't know yet. We'll find out. But we always find out after the fact. So we meticulously documented all these killings and then suicides, where people would kill everyone and shoot themselves. And the media completely left out, just like the shooter at the Virginia Tech or all the others, they were on the medications. Well, what's one of the side effects of the medication? Both suicidal tendencies and homicidal tendencies and delusional tendencies. For example, we went out and filmed all of the people we could in Columbine in Colorado, and we found out from them that it wasn't Eric Harris who had a gun. It was how he was acting out and how he was developing this paranoia and the emotional detachment. Because when you're emotionally detached from the outcome of what you're going to do, then it makes it very easy for you to feel no compassion or empathy for the person that you're hurting. And that's common on these drugs. In fact, the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys in the United States is suicide. When I was growing up, no one ever committed suicide. I mean, ever. So this is the medication. But if the industry and the media were honest and the government were honest and did a really thorough investigation, they would have to go up against the people that give them a lot of money, that have funded all forms of front groups and think tanks and pay for their magazines like the New England Journal of Medicine, American Journal of Psychiatry. All of these are controlled financially. In fact, watch 60 Minutes and see how many of the ads on there were for medications, including medications that the side effect is death. And wouldn't you think that a media would say, gee whiz, first, there are other ways of dealing with this problem. And secondly, you have no scientific proof, not a single study exists showing that there's a brain chemical imbalance causing schizophrenia, bipolar, depression. None of this. It's all supposition, all based upon people who create diseases so they can then create income streams going with it. Now, I've done multiple documentaries on this. I've done many articles on this. Dr. Feldman, who's coming on in a few moments, and I published an article on the dangers of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Now, again, I don't know if this person was on one or not. I do know that it's not that difficult when people reach a point where they can no longer communicate in a normal way, and they revert to talking to themselves, to acting out, being paranoid. And so I think that we have to look at it from a more holistic point of view. Now, but there are people who've been diagnosed with schizophrenia who've been helped with a holistic protocol. And the holistic protocol includes a great deal of niacin, non-flush niacin, 5-hydroxytryptophan, flaxseed oil, folic acid at 2 milligrams a day, B12 at 2 milligrams, gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA, garlic, glutathione, cysteine, glutamic acid, L-glutamic acid, methionine, phenylalanine, the free-form amino acids, high B-complex. These are known to help, along with ginkgo. But you can only do so much nutritionally. It really has to come with the idea that we have a society where so many people have no place to go to get any help with the stress that they're under. And almost all violence against others or oneself occurs when a person is so stressed that they can't take it. Even go to the universities. Even go up to the university to have bridges and see how many of their students jump off. We shouldn't have people jumping off bridges and committing suicide in colleges. But when you set artificial standards that someone's supposed to meet, and then if not a person feels they can't meet them, then they're going to be considered a failure, and or they're not going to succeed or keep up with other people, then they feel that, you know, they have nothing to live for, and they die. We shouldn't make education so competitive or the rewards to get a job so essential that we devalue the life process. Hope that answers your question. And let's go over and say hello to Keith from New York City. Hi, Keith.
Yes. Hello, Gary. How are you? My question is there anything that can be done holistically to help the congresswoman in Arizona?
Well, there's a lot that could be done. One of the very first things I would do is see that she was given some hyperbaric to help stop some of the unnecessary damage, or let's say the damage, secondary damage from the gunshot wound. And also, if she were given ozone, that would help kill a lot of the bacteria so that she doesn't get an infection from that. And then once she begins to come out of critical care, then there's a whole series of protocols that could help with re-stimulating neuron activity, to helping to rebuild new dendrites that might have been damaged. Yeah. Have you looked at the book Mind Power that I wrote? I have protocols for all forms of damage to the brain or advanced degeneration and from inflammatory and plaque buildup in the brain, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, and you use a similar protocol because now a person who is not old and is not suffering from those conditions has blunt trauma that can manifest in a similar way. So turning off inflammation and rebuilding the natural brain chemistry is what I would focus on. And yes, there's a lot that can be done that can enhance her recovery. Okay, and we'll take one more call before we go over to our guest. And you can call in right now, and I'll take it, and then we're going to take a break and come back and speak with Dr. Martin Feldman, who's going to be sharing his insights on selenium. And, let me go over now because I'm looking at my time and I don't want to keep Dr. Feldman rushing at the end of the show. So we're going to give you some more time tonight, Marty.
Great, Gary. Great idea.
Let's talk about selenium.
Selenium. First off, this is a series about medical myths, and there are a lot of medical myths out there which conventional medicine really doesn't appreciate a lot of nutrition. And with selenium, there's two major aspects. One is they think selenium is very minor and unimportant, and second is they think the RDA of 55 micrograms per day is adequate, and neither is true. It's very important, and that RDA is very, very low. Now, why do we need this selenium? What's the story here? Well, first off, do a little physiology. This selenium is a major component of the enzyme glutathione peroxidase, and that's an enzyme which does a few things in the body. First off, it prevents cancer. It helps with all cardiovascular disease to prevent it. There are studies out there that show that the areas with low soil levels of selenium throughout the world have the highest cancer rates among the population. That is, that selenium is very, very related to cancer. Also, it has many other known benefits. For example, it aids in protein synthesis, especially in fertility, especially in men, improves sperm production and motility of the sperm. Now, also very, very important is that it supports the thyroid gland, as the thyroid gland requires selenium to produce T3. Now, the thyroid produces many, we'll call it component parts of thyroid hormone, T4, T3, and others. In America today, the main treatment for a hypothyroid condition is Synthroid. Synthroid is pure T4. However, the T4, to work on the cellular level in the, throughout the body, has to be converted to T3. T3 is the active form of the thyroid hormone that does the work. Selenium is critical in that conversion, as is the periphery of the body, the liver and other components of the periphery of the body help with that conversion. And so does iodine, and so does tyrosine, among other nutrients. But the selenium is very, very key. What about foods? What do we do about foods for selenium? Well, first off, one of the best would be kelp. Kelp is great in terms of selenium, and also helps the thyroid directly, has iodine. Wheat germ, whole grains, nuts, especially Brazil nuts, molasses, barley, oats, whole wheat, brown rice, garlic, onions, mushrooms, all of these have some selenium in them. Also, very high level of selenium is found in brewer's yeast. Brewer's yeast is a big problem in terms of it is a yeast, and many, many, many people out there become allergic to yeast. Either they're allergic to begin with, or over time, if they take brewer's yeast continuously, the percentage of becoming allergic is very, very high, so brewer's yeast is not a great source, although it has a lot of selenium in it. What about selenium supplements? Well, many of our vitamin-mineral combined supplements have some selenium in them. The best forms of selenium, or some of the forms of selenium that are out there, are selenium methionine, selenium cysteine. Also, you can have kelp-derived selenium as a sort of a supplement. We also have a topical selenium, which is a whole different topic. The selenium sulfide goes on the scalp, topically helps with dandruff and other things on the scalp. That's a whole different, separate issue. What about dose? A conservative dose is starting at around 100 mcg, not beyond that. 100 mcg is the beginning dose. 200 mcg is very, very safe for adults. Depending on what's going on in your particular biochemistry, you might need a higher amount of selenium in your diet. It depends on your amount of cancer potential, exposure to toxins, and especially free radicals, because the free radical issue, selenium helps with the glutathione peroxidase, a major anti-free radical substance, and it depends on selenium. So therefore, it's very, very important for people who are exposed to free radicals to have enough selenium as part of a whole process of free radical. But there are many other, of course, many, many other things about free radicals, especially beta-carotene, vitamin C, vitamin E. Now, E and selenium are very important. They're buddies. They work very much together, and they interact with each other, and they're very, very helpful to each other. So if we don't have enough E, we even need more selenium, and if we have too little selenium, we need more E. So we have here a major, actually a major, major nutrient. We have a dose which is very, very safe. It's inexpensive. It has so many benefits that it doesn't get enough respect from conventional medicine, and it should be more on everybody's radar, and it should be part of your, say, healthy nutritional system.
Very good information, Marty.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. Dr. Martin Feldman, more information or questions, you can reach him at 212-744-4413. Just a few final thoughts here before we wrap up our program. MRI scans lead to unnecessary breast cancer surgery. This is from the British Medical Journal. It says, quote, magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, scans of the breast are so sensitive they detect large numbers of non-cancerous tumors and lead to unnecessary breast removal surgeries. That's according to the last study just on this. So a lot of women's breasts are being removed that should not have been removed, and that's unfortunate. And finally, tonight, I'm opposed to genetically engineered food for a simple reason. There are no long-term studies showing that they're safe. And the studies that do exist are industry-supported studies. Independent studies are completely different. This is the latest one. BT Brinogel confirmed to be toxic. Signs of food toxicity in genetically engineered eggplant. That's Brinogel in India. And this is based upon a scientist who who's an environmental epidemiologist and risk assessment expert, that took a look and said, hold on, this eggplant, which is the first food that they were going to do in India that's genetically engineered, it causes inflammation, reproductive disorders, and liver damage. And the report shows why we can't rely upon the genetic engineering industry tests that purport to show the safety of these GMOs and other risky substances. One more reason why we should be very diligent and go only organic, and wherever possible, boycott genetic engineered foods. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the end of our program today. If you miss anything and want to re-listen to the program, all of our programs are posted on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Thank you all for listening. Now let's say hello to Mike on the phone from, I believe he's out in California right now, Mike Rupert. How are you?
I'm great, Gary. It's been just a beautiful, gorgeous, sunny day out here. The rest of the world's having tough weather, but I'm in paradise.
Good. And what are you going to be talking about tonight?
We're bringing back a repeat guest, Bob Waldrop, who runs the Running on Empty discussion groups for Yahoo. We've got 7,000 members, been at it about a decade, got 70,000 archived messages. He got raided because he was growing food and doing all kinds of rebellious terrorist-type things in Oklahoma City, and of course he wasn't. So we're going to talk about that, and we're also going to talk about the tragedy last week in Tucson.
Okay, well, we look forward to the show. And one quick thing for you. This week we discussed on my noon show peak oil and the consequences. And the idea is that where many people, yourself and others, are concerned about peak oil and what happens when we no longer have as much oil, or the oil we have is more expensive and therefore the products made from it are expensive, what's not frequently taken into this equation are the BRIC nations, especially Brazil, that is booming, China, India, and South Korea and some other nations. They're not slowing down. It's as if they don't care about peak oil. They're figuring they can find the oil wherever it is and pay for it, whether it's in the Sudan or someplace else, or take very big risks by drilling for it at twice the depth right out off the Atlantic coast in Brazil. Your thoughts on that?
Well, they aren't really growing as fast as everybody assumes. China is on the verge of imploding, and Russia's kind of maintaining a safe splatter distance right now. Chinese inflation is ravaging food prices, and there's a massive energy shortage because China has lost 40% of its coal supply as a result of the Australian floods. All of the Chinese bubbles are overheating. Brazil's growth is precarious. They've had some civil unrest there. But again, and I covered this in my book, Confronting Collapse, Brazil doesn't have enough oil to save the world, and it may never be able to get that deep water oil that's out there. I mean, if Macondo and Deepwater Horizon was a bridge too far, what they're going after is almost twice as deep.
So you don't see these countries being able to continue a 6 to 10% increase in their growth, especially providing all the luxuries and high standard of living for their middle class and educated class, or they would also be adversely affected by the peak oil?
Well, yeah, I mean, we live in a global economic paradigm. There's not enough resources, there's not enough energy to support the whole thing, and everything is fungible. So there is no one place in the world that's immune now. China's got horrendous problems that I cover daily at the World News Desk at CollapseNet. There's a lot of concern coming up right now from major financial markets and analysts about how well China's actually doing. They're being ravaged by inflation right now. So is Brazil.
I appreciate the insights. Thank you very much. Stay tuned for Michael Rupert right here on the Progressive Radio Network.